Well, good afternoon, KVMR land. My name is Martin Webb, and it's time for this month's edition of the Energy Report. Thanks, in part, goes out to all of the KVMR listeners and members, as well as Planet Solar, providing renewable energy sales and service using sunshine, wind, and water to meet local power needs. Their specialties include on-site consultations, financial cost benefit analysis, and guidance from education and installation. www.planitsolar.com, 530-432-3776. And thanks in part also goes out to Jeannie Toffanelli Home Loans, serving the KVMR listening area with home financing since 1986. Consultations aim to provide sustainable financing solutions for the homeowner, purchaser, builder, investor, and those with unusual circumstances. Jeannie can be reached at 346-9713. Well, going to actually bring the music back up for just a second as we try and get our two guests on today. I'm really excited. We're going to be having a live on-air discussion and debate about the merits of Proposition 7, which is on the ballot at next month's Election Day here in California. It's the Solar and Clean Energy Act of 2008. Be right back in just a moment with Jan Smutney-Jones of No on 7 and Tam Hunt of Yes on 7. Stay tuned, we'll be right back with the Energy Report. Well, good afternoon. We're back here live on KVMR FM 89.5 on your FM dial or KVMR.org, streaming live on the internet 24/7. My name is Martin Webb, and this is the monthly edition of the Energy Report. The first Thursday of every month, we're covering the latest in energy news, issues with production and consumption, and all of the various effects of energy in our lives. And I'm really excited to have a couple of guests on to help our listeners sort out the issues surrounding Prop number 7. Tam Hunt, are you with us?
I am.
We've got Tam Hunt on the line. He's going to be representing the Yes on 7, and Tam, you're the Energy Program Director, the staff attorney for the Community Environmental Council, is that correct?
I am, yeah.
And Jan Smutney-Jones, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Jan is the Executive Director of Independent Energy Producers. I want to thank both of you for making time today to be a part of the program.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I want to make sure you both know that we're not going to be doing call-ins, and listeners, I'm sorry, we're not going to be taking time for call-ins. We're just going to try and discuss Prop 7 because it is a proposition that that has several facets to it, and I know that in some cases people get confused about exactly what these different issues that are being addressed here. And so what I want to start off with is Tam, with the Yes on 7 side, if you could just give us a little bit of your background just so people know exactly who you are and what sort of credibility you bring to this discussion that we're going to have today. What is your role in the campaign? And then just give us a little bit about why this proposition is being brought up now and a quick summary about what you're trying to accomplish so that I can give Jan a moment to introduce himself and then really get going on the discussion. So let our listeners know, Tam, who are you? What do you do? What's your involvement? And just a succinct summary about what's trying to be accomplished with Prop 7.
Sure. Yeah, I'll keep it brief. I'm a lawyer by training. I've worked on state policy for about 4 years now. And we're independent policy advocates. We have endorsed Prop 7 as an organization, but we have not received compensation from the campaign, nor will we accept compensation in the future. Again, we're independent. We think it's good policy, and so some background on our decision. California put in place an ambitious law in 2002 to achieve 20% renewables by 2017. That was advanced to 2010 by legislation last year. And unfortunately, in the 6 years we've had that law on the books, we've seen only 400 megawatts of new renewables come online. And so everyone would agree it's not working very well. And so even though you can look ahead about 5 years and see we have a lot of contracts in place and probably we'll have a lot of projects in place in the ground in the next 5 years or so, we still don't have anywhere near as many as we need to achieve the higher levels of renewables, such as 33% by 2020, which is the official goal, not yet a legal mandate, but the goal of the state. And so the question is, how do we improve things? And so Prop 7 essentially says, look, we're going to set higher goals, but what really is important in Prop 7 is not the actual numbers for the goals. which doubled the RPS from 20% by 2010 to 40% by 2020. What's more important is the tools in Prop 7 to achieve those higher numbers. And so just very quickly, the tools it includes include a revised process to calculate what's called the market price. And this is kind of the very important proxy for electricity from a natural gas plant. We should consider kind of the base load status quo power supply in California, and renewables are compared to the market price in terms of their being cost effective or not. And that is really key in having contracts approved and incentivizing new renewables. That process is revised, given to the Energy Commission, and the Energy Commission must consider, quote unquote, the value and benefits of renewables in that calculation, which is a change in current law and a big change potentially. Prop 7 allows a 10% leeway on top of the market price for new renewable contracts. This is another big boost for renewables. Currently, you don't get any leeway. It has to be at or below the market price to be considered cost effective, with some complications going to further in the program. And then the last tool I'll focus on right now in the intro is what's called a feed-in tariff. And Prop 7 has a feed-in tariff, which basically says if you are a renewable producer and you have a project that you can sell at or below the market price, again, the all-important figure here, then the utilities have to buy that power. It's called a must-buy provision. And this is similar to a law that was implemented in California in the 80s and 90s very successfully, a federal law called PURPA, which resulted in about 10,000 megawatts of new renewables at that time. So Prop 7 has a number of tools to achieve the higher goals, and we think on balance it's good policy.
And is Prop 7, like a lot of ballot initiatives, is the intent of it to really expedite the political process with clean energy, or is this something that's intended to go hand in hand with politicians? I know in some cases ballot initiatives are sort of an end run about an issue that politicians are gridlocked on or moving too slow on. Or is this something that's intended to work hand in hand with political things that are already going on?
Well, it definitely revises current law. And so, you know, California energy policy is notoriously complex. It's hundreds of pages of code and statutes. And Prop 7 doesn't blow it all up. What it does is it makes some judicious changes to certain parts of current law. And so even though it doesn't create a whole new system, it tweaks the current system. It is saying effectively to the lawmakers in California, you're not doing your job. And so for that reason, they certainly don't like it very much. And a lot of folks certainly have considered, that there are various debates about the merits of Prop 7. I'm sure Jan will go into in a minute here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thanks for that, Tam. Jan, go ahead and give us a little bit of background on who you are, your involvement with this campaign to defeat Proposition 7, and in a nutshell, why you think that this is something that is either the wrong thing or the wrong time.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm Jan Smutty Jones, and I'm the executive director of the Independent Energy Producers Association. I, too, am a lawyer by training, and I've been working in the renewable sector in one form or another pretty much since 1980. My organization, the Independent Energy Producers, represents about 80% of the delivered energy from renewable projects here in California. And IEP has been around since 1982. We were instrumental, actually, in the implementation of PURPA, which Tam just referred to, back in the 80s. I have obviously been very actively engaged for a long period of time trying to encourage additional renewable resources into the California energy mix. So it's with a great deal of irony we find ourselves, and perhaps awkwardness, in opposition to Proposition 7, which purports to pretty much guarantee a 50% market share for new renewables. We don't believe it does that. We believe that there are some very basic structural problems with the proposition that will make it less likely, not more likely, that we will add new renewable resources here. And we're seeing this, ironically, as a pretty big threat to the renewable market here in California. I might add that it's not just my organization, IEP, but other trade associations representing renewables as well, like the California Solar Energy Industries Association, the California Wind Association, California, Coalition for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Technology, all believe that this proposition, no matter how well intended, is actually missing the mark. We think the initiative is structured around, basically has taken some of the problems with the existing structure and have added some new bells and whistles to it that perhaps makes that don't correct those problems, and in fact adds some additional confusion with respect to who's doing what going forward. So we view this as unfortunately, no matter how well intended, an initiative that the mechanics, which are very real here, the mechanics of this proposition will actually make it more difficult for renewables to actually develop here in California.
I think that there's definitely been a lot of confusion on the parts of voters who are concerned about the interesting alliances being forged for and against Proposition 7. And as energy is becoming more of an issue on the political scene, it's interesting to see different alliances that people normally aren't sure of how to vote, and so they look towards, okay, you know, who is supporting and who's for and who is against. And it's interesting to see that is confusing some people on this issue, because I think generally across the board, most everyone is interested in supporting clean energy and changes in energy production and consumption. And this is, Tam, is it correct to say that this is generally a ballot measure that is addressing production of energy? Is it solely just aiming just at production of energy? This isn't something that's addressing consumption of energy. It's just all about production?
Yeah, that's accurate. California has a number of initiatives underway to promote energy efficiency and reduce consumption more generally. So this is about renewable energy production. You're right.
And so let's dive into some of the facets of this, because one thing that I think is always a little bit more difficult for voters trying to decide on ballot initiatives is when they are complicated or appear to be complicated or have a lot of bullet points to them, so to speak. And for instance, I'm referring to the voter's guide, the general election official voter information guide that people are going to be receiving soon if they already haven't. If people are interested in Prop 7 and are trying to figure out what it actually does, there's definitely quite a bullet point list of several things here. I'm going to go ahead and read right out of the voter guide. And what I'd like to do is try and address what you both feel are the most important aspects of this, because I don't think that we're going to be able to address all of these and give both sides an opportunity to discuss it. So let me quickly go through here. This is the actual official voter information guide, the overview of the measure. It says this measure makes a number of changes regarding the renewable portfolio standard, the RPS, and that is referring to the mandate that utility companies, right now it's investor-owned utility companies, that must get a certain amount of their power from renewable sources. And the measure makes a number of changes regarding not just the renewable portfolio standard, but also the permitting of electricity generating facilities and transmission lines. Primarily, the measure does these several things. It establishes higher targets for renewable energy for electricity providers. It makes those renewable energy requirements enforceable on publicly owned utilities. This measure would also change the process for defining the market price of electricity. This measure would change the cost cap provisions that limit the electricity obligations under the renewable portfolio standard. It expands the scope of enforcement. It revises the contracting period, which means that utilities, I believe, need to sign longer contracts of, I believe it's 20 years. I'll ask you guys to speak to that. Sets a lower penalty rate and removes the cap on the total penalty amount for failure to meet these renewable energy requirements. It also directs exactly how to use those penalty revenues. And furthermore, finally, it expands the Energy Commission's permitting authority. That's an awful lot of stuff. And first, Tam, I guess I'd say a question that I'd like you to address and voters might want to address is all of this, you know, how is all of this tied together, and why all of these numbers of changes? I'm assuming that there was clearly some thought put into this that, you know what, we can't get rid of any of these changes. This needs to be one comprehensive package all tied together. And are there main bullet points out of that list that I think, that you think people need to understand these are the important aspects of this. Don't get caught up in the confusion of all these different issues. How concise and what are the main points that, that you guys are really trying to get across? Do what you can to try and give voters and listeners a simpler way of really thinking about all of these issues that would be changed by this. And if you could, give us a little direction on what you feel like are the main issues that we should focus on. And I'll ask the same of Jan for the remaining 20 minutes that we have.
Yeah, well, definitely. Again, this is complex stuff. And so just to break it down in kind of the most simple terms here, you know, again, most people would acknowledge right now the current process in California is not working very well. Again, we've got only 400 megawatts online in the last 6 years. That's a small chunk of change compared to what we need to get in the next 10, 20 years. What Prop 7 does essentially is provide a number of changes to the current RPS system, as it's called, the Renewable Portfolio Standard. And this is the set of rules that apply to utilities to achieve higher levels of renewables like wind, solar, geothermal, et cetera. And so essentially, you know, at its most basic level, what Prop 7 does is provide more incentives, more tools to achieve higher goals. There's a long debate about the stick side of the debate. And so while Prop 7 does eliminate the cap for renewable RPS noncompliance penalties, it does reduce the cents per kilowatt hour penalty. The ultimate effect of this change is to actually allow for increased penalties. One level deeper, though, in the debate is that Prop 7 does have some more loopholes, and personally wish it didn't. You know, I acknowledge fully that Prop 7 is not perfect. It has some loopholes in there. But again, the key change here is that Prop 7 is more about carrots than it is about sticks. And this is smart in my view because we have basically a system right now with the PUC, with its five commissioners, four of them are appointed by Schwarzenegger right now, and they're even with the fifth, also Peavy, who is appointed by Davis, all fairly utility-friendly at this point. And so the chances of that commission applying penalties to the utilities for noncompliance are, in my view, pretty low under current law or Prop 7. And so really the idea of approaching this problem of more renewables from a point of view of penalties, the stick, the big stick approach, is problematic. And so I think Prop 7 is very smart in going for the big carrot approach, giving more incentives, more tools to get more renewables.
So yeah, let me ask a question then about the penalty. Folks, you know, aren't probably aware about some of the details regarding the current RPS, the Renewable Portfolio Standard. So, is it correct that if utility companies do not meet the current standard of a certain percent by a certain time, that the penalty is 5 cents per kilowatt hour of renewable energy that's not obtained, but there's an annual cap on the dollar amount penalty? So even if 5 cents a kilowatt hour comes to greater than a certain amount, greater than the cap, it's still going to be capped.
It is, yeah, and we've crunched the numbers on that. So essentially, under the current system, you have that cap you just mentioned, and that's really kind of a pittance compared to utilities that are making billions each year. With Prop 7 lifting that cap and requiring, or pardon me, forbidding any imposition of a cap in the future by the PUC, the effect is that any time a utility is about 2% or more noncompliance, meaning if you had to get to 20% by 2010 and you hit 18%, you're 2% in arrears. When you go 2% and above, on the Prop 7, the penalties are a lot higher. Yeah, so the effect, again, is to actually increase penalties.
So that with Prop 7, the per kilowatt hour penalty is reduced to 1 cent per kilowatt hour, but there is no annual cap, and that in your estimation there are certain situations that would arise where that annual amount, even though it's a lower per kilowatt hour amount, the overall penalty would be larger, and that this proposition would instruct that those penalty revenues go back into renewable energy transmission issues as opposed to just going into the general fund. Is that correct understanding?
Yeah, I would just correct that statement with one change and say that in almost all situations, the penalties under Prop 7 that may be assessed are higher. But again, I do want to stress that, you know, it's really unlikely under current law or Prop 7 penalties will be assessed. And this is kind of not a very commonly accepted view, admittedly, but I think it's an accurate view. And so, again, Prop 7 is more about those carrots, those incentives to get to higher renewables than it is about the penalties.
Great. Yeah, let me give Jan a chance to break in here.
Well, just to to chime in on this, and in fact, I think I'm in agreement with Tam. I mean, both under the, it remains to be seen what the current commission would do with the existing law, since the time for penalties hasn't quite come yet. But either the existing system, and certainly under Prop 7, you have a number of what I would call off-ramps in terms of reasons why a utility, or it's not just utilities, there are other parties that are subject to these penalties, why they can be forgiven. And so I think there's a sufficient amount of off-ramps here under either case that I'm not sure that there's a lot more teeth in Prop 7 than you have under current law.
Okay, well, Jan, give us your opinion on what you feel like are the main reasons why people should consider voting no, because it is what I would consider a very thorough ballot initiative that's addressing multiple specific points in how renewable energy is factored into the mix. What do you feel are the strongest reasons that people should really be skeptical about this? And any comments that you have about TAM as far as the PUC versus the CEC. That's another interesting facet of this. As I was reading about Prop 7, is there are various aspects where the Public Utility Commission regulation and oversight and authority is being pulled away from the PUC and is being handed to the California Energy Commission, which is the CEC. So generally, what are your main complaints that you think people should look at? And then specifically about this subtle change in oversight.
Well, let me throw several of them out there, and then we can circle back. And again, I'm approaching this from the standpoint of someone who represents people who actually want to build renewable projects, put steel in the ground. And we're looking at this based on how the existing system's working, what works, what doesn't, and we're very much engaged right now in actually trying to reform the existing system. So with that in mind, one of the problems that we have with the existing system, at least from my trade association's perspective, is this reliance on this market reference price that Tam referred to earlier, market price referent process. That we think sort of skews things the wrong direction. It's time-consuming, and it's not particularly useful from the standpoint of finding out what the value of a project actually what is the actual value of a project. We would like to see something much more competitive and less administratively directed as a way of actually ferreting those issues out. The second area I think is a sort of a useful. There's a debate going on with respect to we've read this initiative from the standpoint of we believe that it basically excludes projects that are less than 30 megawatts from actually complying with the RPS provisions of the initiative. We think it is a drafting error, and I'll let Tam speak for the yes folks. I know they disagree with that, but we see this as a very serious problem, and again, something that is likely to lead to additional litigation at a point where that we don't really believe that we have got that amount of time. The third area that I think is important is in the area of transmission, and I think there was an effort in this initiative to move the transmission authority from the PUC to the Energy Commission, but it's not really clear if they've actually accomplished that or if we've left jurisdiction in both entities. We've had a number of people look at this. Even alleged analysts' opinion kind of throws up their hands. They don't know really who has jurisdiction over these transmission lines. And no matter who does, it utilizes an existing definition of transmission line, which only applies to a very narrow set of transmission facilities from the generator to a first point of interconnection. So we're not sure that that there's jurisdiction over the large transmission lines, which need to be added to basically be able to bring the renewable resources in from the Mojave Desert, Salton Sea, Coastal Range, those kinds of places. So this is a significant problem. And sort of last but not least, and just to put this all into terms of why this becomes a problem, is in order to fix any of this, it requires a two-thirds vote of the legislature for the intent, and then only for the intents and purposes of the legislature, and then only with the governor agreeing to that, we believe that's extremely high hurdle to try to get, things as arcane as some of the issues that are arising here fixed. So those are the issues that we view from a renewable energy business as something that's really dampening the potential market here for renewables, and that's why Again, the renewable industry is really united in its opposition to this initiative, notwithstanding the fact that this initiative is promising us a 50% market share.
Okay, Tam, there are a couple issues here that I know I've heard people bring up that it'd be good to give you an opportunity to respond to the 30 megawatt issue. That's something that people are claiming that this ballot initiative would exclude projects that are less than 30 megawatts, and listeners may have no idea how to quantify that, what sort of metric we're talking about. And right now there is no such solar project that's even over 30 megawatts in North America right now.
That's not entirely accurate. I could address it if you'd like.
Yeah, and is the wording such that it excludes 30 megawatt projects? And if so, you know, what is the story there? And then also about, that is an interesting point about ballot initiatives. It's difficult to amend them after the fact. It either takes another ballot initiative or 2/3 of the legislature. So if you could speak to the 30 megawatts and then the risks of putting something in that is difficult to change.
Yeah, well, I'll address those issues certainly one by one here. So 30 megawatts. 30 megawatts is an energy plant basically big enough to serve about 20,000 homes. So that's pretty big. And essentially, though, the Prop 7 changes provide an expedited permitting process for solar and clean energy plants that are defined as 30 megawatts and above. Prop 7 does not change current law regarding projects that are eligible under the RPS system we've talked about already. And this is pretty clear because you have two different codes. You have the Public Utilities Code for the RPS and the Public Resources Code for transmission. And so opponents have basically said, look, you have solar and clean energy plant defined as 30 megawatts and above in the Public Resources Code for transmission, and then they're applying that same definition to the Public Utilities Code for the RPS. And that's just not good legal construction. And so, you know, certainly there is room for debate here, but I think definitely the better view, and I have, you know, strong confidence that court or agency interpreting this law will support my view, is that basically Prop 7 makes no change to current law regarding the size of projects that qualify for the RPS. And so essentially there's no negative impact on smaller projects from Prop 7, and in my view some very positive impacts will come about because you'll have economies of scale from a large build-out of renewables like solar and wind that will transfer down to the smaller kind of residential scale projects. In terms of transmission issues, I don't read Prop 7 as applying only to what are called gen ties. I read Prop 7 as applying to any transmission in the state required for renewables. And so certainly I think there is an issue there in terms of not explicitly cutting off the PUC's authority to site transmission, but certainly is the better view, and I think a view that a court will uphold, is that because Prop 7 does give authority over transmission lines to the CEC, then, of course, by extension, it distinguishes that authority from the PUC. And then in terms of the third objection Jan raised, a 2/3 vote, I think, is, if you have a good policy being put in place by an initiative, a good hurdle, because if you don't have that kind of high hurdle to overcome, then the legislature, which is, of course, not immune to industry pressure and lobbying from utilities, et cetera, will quickly change the features of that law. So if the law itself, the initiative that's passed, is good, then it's good to have a high hurdle.
Now, explain a little bit again about the 30 megawatt, because I'm a little bit confused. I know if I'm confused, listeners might be confused there. And I had a hard time myself trying to understand what that 30 megawatt reference in the text in the voter guide actually was referring to. And so you're saying that the 30 megawatt quantification does not refer to the minimum system size of a generating system that's eligible for the RPS, but instead it is some sort of trigger for how this initiative looks at transmission?
It is, yes. The current law basically gives jurisdiction over power plants 50 megawatts and above to the Energy Commission. And those are thermal power plants, so basically natural gas, et cetera. Prop 7 gives additional jurisdiction to the CEC, the Energy Commission, for solar and clean energy plants, which are defined as 30 megawatts and above that are renewable. So it's expanding that jurisdiction and taking away some jurisdiction from county governments because of the desire to avoid NIMBYism. NIMBYism is a real problem with renewables around the state and transmission. And so, again, it's trying to take away those hurdles to a more robust renewable build-out. And then some folks have, in my view, misread Prop 7 to interpret that as applying to RPS-eligible projects also, which I think is just basically a poor interpretation of the law.
Yeah, we obviously would disagree with that. In Section 7 of the proposition, it actually changes the definition from electric generating facility to a solar and clean energy facility. And if you run the definition through the definition of facility used also in the proposition refers to a solar and clean energy plant.
But that's in the PRC,
hold on a second, Tam. And a solar and clean energy plant is defined, as Tam has accurately pointed out, the 30 megawatts or above. I'll point out in Section 7, you know, throughout the code here, the Public Resources Code, which pertains to the siting issue that Tam referred to earlier, and the Public Utilities Code, basically refer back and forth to each other. And what I'm saying is in Section 7, they actually explicitly refer to one another. So we believe that this is a serious problem. As you can understand, you've got two lawyers here coming to different conclusions over what the language means. And my concern is, again, from an industry perspective, is now we don't have a lot of time to litigating these issues. As Tam indicated, there are a lot of folks there are a lot of our fellow Californians who, for whatever localized reasons, may not like specific renewable projects, may not like specific transmission facilities, and we're just very, very much concerned that feeding them any ammunition at all actually pushes us backwards. And that's really kind of, I think, the source of this debate on this specific issue.
Now, both of you seem to be in agreement, perhaps, on that the current process seems to not be working. I heard both of you say that, in perhaps different terms, that you both want to are personally interested in making the process for California bringing on more renewable energy online. The current process needs to be worked on and fixed and tweaked, and that you both appear to think that there's different ways to go about doing this. Are you both in agreement that the current process needs to be fixed and that, Tam, you see that this is a good way to address that, but, Jan, you feel like there's better ways to address that? Is that kind of a real simplistic summary?
Yeah, I would say definitely. Jan, that agreement that we need to have some changes, and I'm happy to see Jan's recent comments to the PUC and the Energy Commission on feed-in tariffs. IEPA has supported a 20-megawatt increase in the current feed-in tariff arrangement, and I support that also. I would ask you, if I may, Martin, a question of Jan. Jan, have you looked at and are you concerned about the prevailing wage requirements in Prop 7? This hasn't been raised before, but I understand it is a concern by some in the industry because that would, of course, potentially increase costs for folks like your members.
Jan?
Well, actually, most of my members build using project labor agreements, so this has not really been a major issue with us and with respect to this. With this specific initiative and the jobs, as far as I know, with respect to people who actually operate power plants, they're very well-paying jobs. So this has not been a major issue, certainly within my association. Our bigger issues, as I said earlier, are really the impacts that this has on getting any jobs to California based on the fact that we think that this initiative will dampen the investment climate for actually building out those renewables. So from our perspective, that's kind of a very serious problem.
And Tam, I have a question for you, and Jan, I'm going to sort of have the same question that I'd like you to answer, and sort of a slightly different perspective. Instead of saying, you know, what would happen if your side wins, so to speak, instead, Tam, what do you see would be what would be the problem, what would be the bad result if Prop 7 does not pass? What risk do voters should voters be aware of if this doesn't pass? Are we just back to square one and we're still working forward in various ways? What are the risks if people don't vote for this that you feel like, look, folks, this is what you'd be considering? If this doesn't pass, imagine this reality is where we're going to be at. What do you see happening if the other side wins?
Yeah, well, I think if Prop 7 is defeated, then essentially and opportunities missed to put in place some pretty robust tools for higher renewables. And certainly, you know, everyone from the legislature to the governor and everyone else supports renewables in a big way. But the question is, how do we get the pricing to the right level to support a really robust build-out of renewables, along with the other problems about transmission and NIMBYism, which are certainly important issues also. And so, you know, there is a healthy disagreement about the right tools to put in place. And there are definitely many debates going on in California right now. And, in fact, there is legislation in the works yet again for next year to put in place a legal mandate for 33% renewables by 2020. The last bill to try to do that, SB 411, was defeated a few weeks ago. And I wasn't too upset because it basically was a higher mandate but with no new tools to achieve that mandate. So Prop 7 has a higher mandate but also has tools in it. And so we've already had three attempts in the legislature to put in place a higher RPS mandate, and they've all failed. Next year we'll see another attempt if Prop 7 fails. And I hold out some hope they'll actually put some new tools in there. But again, the most recent version didn't have those tools in there. And so, you know, it's not going to be the end of the world as we know it if Prop 7 fails, but certainly it will be an opportunity lost.
So worst thing that could happen is just a delay in these similar types of reforms, thereby delaying, you know, bringing clean energy online and all the benefits that we all know come with that.
Definitely, yeah. Just one more final point. We do, as an organization, support much higher levels of renewables. We see electrification of transportation as a very promising route to reducing our petroleum dependency in the coming decades. Under that paradigm, we need to have a huge build-out of renewables, both small, medium-scale, and large-scale. And so Prop 7 definitely will help us, in our view, a long way toward that goal by giving these new tools to a much more robust renewables build-out.
Great. And Jan, so the same question for you. What kind of picture can you paint for voters as far as what do you see the worst thing that could happen if this proposition passes? It sounds like you're envisioning lawsuits, extra money, delays, but what?
Yeah. Well, let me just kind of follow up with your earlier question, which I think there's actually Tam and I are in a general agreement that the existing system needs to be fixed, that there are, in fact, problems with it. And my association, the Independent Energy Producers, is spending a considerable amount of time and effort in trying to move in a positive direction. And I think Tam was also correct in basically saying changing the number from, you know, 20% to 33% and not changing some of the underlying problems really doesn't get you very far. So I think there's sort of a general agreement there. There's a very big disagreement, however, with respect to whether or not this initiative would really help us move forward. I think we view this as a situation that will basically push us backwards. We do believe it'll put more uncertainty into the system. We do believe that there are some issues that we've already talked about with respect to transmission and perhaps this 30-megawatt program that's sort of ripe for litigation and will basically create additional delay and additional uncertainty in the California renewable market at a point in time where we really can't afford that. We're not doing renewables here just for the sake of renewables. The renewable resources are an integral part of our global climate change strategy here in the state. We basically have to be getting them built in a much more efficient manner. So we view this as basically pushing us backwards. You know, and in the last, 2 weeks, I've had, two different CEOs of companies that are trying to build new solar projects, basically, and one of them just flat out said, this thing passes, I'm going to have to shift my capital into the Nevada market until this place sorts itself out. And that's the kind of signal that we don't think we can afford right. Well, we can't afford right now. And that's why we in the independent renewable community are asking voters to vote no on Proposition 7.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time, so let me give you both a couple of minutes to wrap up, make some final statements, and also make sure that you leave the listeners with ways to get more info about each of your sides, how a website, for instance, where they could go and find out more about yes or no on Prop 7. Tam Hunt, go ahead and give us a couple minutes of your final closing thoughts here on why people should vote yes on Prop 7 this fall.
Sure. So, again, we acknowledge, Jan and I both, that there's problems that need to be fixed. The question is, how do we do that? We think Prop 7 has a lot of good tools in it to help move us forward. And I would note, too, that, I've had you know, extensive dialogues with various groups, my colleagues in the environmental community. I haven't talked with Jan personally about this offline, but I've been in various forums with Jan. I've talked to some of the big companies like OptiSolar and GreenVolts. And frankly, most people really don't understand what Prop 7 does. They are deferring to two or three people who don't like Prop 7 for various reasons. They have not looked into the details. And if they did, I think they might actually find they like it a lot more than certain opponents have suggested they should. And details matter. You know, this is all about the details here because everyone agrees on the end goal. So the details are really the key part of the debate here. In terms of more information, we are going to have a flyer prepared this week with our views on Prop 7. That will be at www.cecsb.org. Again, we're not part of the campaign. We're independent. The campaign website is yeson7.net.
Great, Tam. Thanks for that. And Jan, a couple minutes of closing comments and how people can find more info out.
Yeah, well, to find more information, you can go to knowonprop7.org. There'll be additional information there. By way of closing here, we, the independent renewable community, who really wants to build additional resources in California, find ourselves in a very ironic position of having to oppose a proposition that purports to give us a 50% market share. If it really did that, we would obviously be supporting it, not opposing it. We believe that no matter how well-intentioned Proposition 7 is, it can't deliver. It is, in essence, a false promise, and that will lead to further delay in terms of trying to get us to a more renewable future. So we are asking voters, again, as the industry that would like to put more renewable steel in the ground, to vote no on Proposition 7 in November. And, you know, I think as the San Jose Mercury News characterized it, that, you know, the no on 7 is the green vote in November. So we would encourage people to vote no. And hopefully as the legislature gets back into session next year, we can basically move to a broader renewable energy mix for California's future.
Well, I want to thank you both, Jan Smutney-Jones, Executive Director of Independent Energy Producers, Tam Hunt, the Energy Program Director and Staff Attorney for the Community Environmental Council. Thank you both for all of the energy and concern that you're putting into clean energy and all of your work. And I think we're just going to have to wait to see what happens after Election Day. And thanks so much for helping KVMR's listeners find out more about this important proposition.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, it's been another fun energy report. Sorry that we couldn't devote a lot longer time to the subject. And there is also Proposition 10. Proposition 10 is another energy-related ballot initiative. I just encourage people to go to the internet, read your voter information guide, and be as aware as possible and do the best you can. It's just great to actually see that clean energy is a political initiative that people want to see more happening on. So with that, we want to close out and make room for the flea market here on your Thursday afternoon broadcast day for KVMR-FM. Thanks in part goes out to Planet Solar, providing renewable energy sales and service for homes, businesses, and public properties. Their specialties include site consultations, financial cost-benefit analysis, and project management for new construction and retrofits. www.planitsolar.com, 530-432-3776. Thanks in part also goes out to Jeannie Toffanelli Home Loans, serving the KVMR listening area with home financing since 1986. Consultations aim to provide sustainable financing solutions for the homeowner, purchaser, builder, investor, and those with unusual circumstances. Jeannie can be reached at 346-9713. I'll be back the first Thursday in November, noon to 1, here on KVMR-FM, Nevada City. My name is Martin Webb. It's been fun spending this time with you on the Energy Report. Stay tuned for the flea market and the community calendar.